Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Media at LSE and to the LSE. My name is Roger Silverstone. I'm Professor of Media and Communications here at the school. And it's my very, very great pleasure to welcome Bill Melody here this evening. Bill Melody is visiting professor in Media at LSE currently. And he wasn't till recently, at least very recently, a professor of the economics of infrastructures in the Faculty of Technology, Policy and Management at the Technical University of Delft in the Netherlands. That's quite a mouthful, but it's not the last mouthful. He's also managing director of Learning Initiatives for Reforms in Network Economics. His long, productive, and by no means over career has taken him from the University of Nebraska, where he undertook his academic training, to the Federal Communications Commission, where he was chief economist, to the Annenberg School for Communications at Penn, to professor and chair of the Department of Communications at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, and then to the UK as the first director of the ESRC, the Economic and Social Research Council's Programme on Information and Communication Technologies, which is where I met him for the first time. And I have to say it was a meeting that significantly changed my career. For the better or for the worse is another matter. After that, he went to St. Anthony's College in Oxford, to Victoria in Australia, where he established a new centre for research on communication and information technologies, and then to the Technical University of Denmark, where he established the Centre for Teleinformation. His work ranges from economics and policy in telecommunications and post-telecommunications, and he has published over 150 books, reports, and articles in professional journals. His views are both radical and challenging. Above all, at least from my point of view, what distinguishes him from so many working in his field is his sensitivity both to the human and to the social at the heart of the analysis of the economics of communication. So it's my great pleasure this evening to welcome Bill Melody to lecture on, or at least to answer the question, hopefully, can the internet economy be governed? And if so, how? Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Melody.
Thank you, Roger. As you can tell from Roger's introduction, if you keep moving fast enough, they won't catch up with you. It is indeed a pleasure to be here and be part of a new activity at the LSE. I have had the good fortune of spending a good portion of my career in association with the creation of new ventures, new centers, new programs, new units of study. They have all involved multidisciplinary activities. They've all carried great interest, great challenges, great excitement, great problems, and now that Roger is leading a new initiative here at LSE, it's my pleasure to join and be part of it. The topic for this evening is extremely timely, for I think we are at a momentous period in the development of not only the internet, but of the 21st century economy. And I guess before I get into it, I should thank you all for coming back from the May Day demonstrations to participate in this event. Until the collapse of the dot-com stocks plunged the information and communication technologies sector into decline, the prevailing dominant view of internet governance was that government should stay away from the internet. They could only do harm by restraining this giant wave of unparalleled innovation that was creating a new, unbelievable internet economy. The charge was led by the likes of the colorful John Perry Barlow of the Electronic Frontier Foundation with his Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace and the then ICT technology guru and prolific author George Gilder. In fact, although generally not recognized by the public, the internet was governed at the time in a variety of ways. Indirectly by the U.S. Department of Defense that was funding the developments, AT&T that was providing the facility networks, and the Federal Communications Commission, which was regulating the terms and conditions for the provision of all services. But it was not an overt or recognized form of governance. In retrospect, it was not very good governance at all, in significant part because governments gave too much credibility to the hype being pumped out by the immediate beneficiaries of internet development under a biased and narrowly focused system of governance. Some governments, including the UK, were sucked into believing that they too could get a piece of the internet economy bounty through monopoly 3G spectrum auctions, and so contributed significantly to the boom and bust of the first internet economy business cycle, rather than to the stabilization of internet economy growth. The dot-com collapse dramatized both the need and the demands for strengthened internet governance institutions and structures in many different ways. These range from a major restructuring of the current governance organization, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, or ICANN, to the strengthening of existing forms of regulation, such as financial reporting standards applied to dot-com and ICT sector firms, and to new laws relating to intellectual property rights, electronic contracts, privacy, security, fraud, and related matters. Last year, ICANN President Stuart Lin joined a growing list of ICANN critics and proposed that its governance authority be strengthened and government representatives be appointed to ICANN board positions. This prompted ICANN critic Michael Fromkin to observe that ICANN, which was created to save the internet from governments, is now turning to governments to save ICANN. During the period of the rise and fall of the dot-coms, the continuing convergence of ICTs, digitalization of communication, particularly telecommunication networks, and the increasing development of multimedia services on the internet prompted recognition in many countries that the existing structures of industry-specific governance in telecommunication and broadcasting were becoming obsolete and needed to be refashioned in light of the characteristics and requirements of integrated electronic communication networks and their increasingly important role in the future economy. The internet is rapidly becoming the foundation for the future economy in a manner similar to the role of electricity and transport in the industrial economy. The evolving new economy is variously labeled the internet, information, or knowledge economy. Clearly, the time is ripe, if not overdue, to address the issue of internet governance in an internet economy. This governance structure must examine internet-related issues at three different levels. First, direct internet-specific issues, such as domain names, root server structures, and the architecture of code development, which tend to be relatively new governance issues, although lessons can be learned from examining the experience of ICANN to date, as well as the historical evolution of other technologies, such as the telegraph and telephone. A second level of governance relates to ICT sector governance issues that are rendering obsolete the inherited industry-specific governance mechanisms for telecommunication, broadcasting, and computing. The UK Communications Bill and the creation of Ofcom are a response to these developments. The third level of governance relates to broader issues associated with the implications of widespread internet use throughout the economy, and for economic, social, cultural, and political relationships. These include such issues as privacy, security, consumer protection, intellectual property rights, electronic contract enforcement, and increasingly, spam control. A study came out a day or two ago that now approximately 50% of the messages on the internet are spam, and it's growing. The challenge here is adapting or replacing inherited economic governance mechanisms to to the new internet economy environment so as to reflect societal values and public policy objectives. These are the most pervasive issues of internet governance, but their scope for effectiveness is determined in significant part by the constraints imposed and or the opportunities made possible by governance at the ITC sector and internet-specific levels. The combined effects of governance at all three levels in this structure will determine the extent to which the internet economy can be governed and how. The effectiveness and implications of the governance system for a new medium of communication, such as the internet, will significantly shape future economies and societies. One is reminded of the work of Harold Innes on the development and application of earlier communication technologies, and his observation as follows. We can perhaps assume that use of a medium of communication over a long period will to some extent determine the character of knowledge to be communicated, and suggest that its pervasive influence will eventually lead to the emergence of a new civilization. I have posed the question, can the internet be governed deliberately? As it is an open question whether traditional forms and structures of governance can be applied effectively in the internet economy. This dilemma has been posed independently by a few leading economists examining the future economy without any special reference to internet developments. For example, in his book, 21st Century Capitalism, Robert Heilbrunner notes, and I quote, "The question for the future, then, becomes our estimate of the extent to which market processes will threaten economic growth and stability, and of the likelihood that the redress of market failures will lie within the political capabilities of a social order whose vitality lies in the accumulation of capital." And from the very different perspective of an internet development specialist, Manuel Castells concludes his recent book, The Internet Galaxy, by observing, "The new economy is overdue for new flexible procedures of institutional regulation. Systemic volatility of global financial markets and vast disparities in the utilization of human resources require new forms of regulation adapted to the new technology and to the new market economy. It will not be easy." Unfortunately, those authors who have documented in various ways the need for a new system of governance of the internet economy have not indicated how such a system of governance might be designed or function to avoid what economists refer to as the risk of systemic market failure, that is, major instabilities with periodic economic crises. It should by now be clear that the issue of governance of the internet economy goes well beyond the narrow debates about industry regulation and deregulation that have characterized much policy research and debate in recent years. Indeed, much deregulation was and is justified by the obsolescence of inherited regulations established in a different era that no longer were relevant. And the re-regulation is justified by special failures in the new market arrangements in specific communication industries. Each reflects a response to specific developments and problems in a specific industry at a particular stage in the evolution of the sector. The governance or regulation of a specific industry or sector of the economy, such as telecommunication or broadcasting, was established to address specific issues of market failure, that is, unsustainable conditions of effective competition, and or extra market public policy goals. The standard examples being universal service, public interest broadcast programming. That is, collectively, it is inherent deficiencies in the unregulated functioning of these industries. In contrast, governance at the level of the internet economy as a whole is needed to address issues related to the very success of the new internet economy. If internet development achieves all its potential and fully pervades economic relations, what are the likely implications for the functioning of such an economy? Is it likely to be stable and provide benefits for all segments of society? Will it be possible to govern such an economy in a roughly parallel manner to the way we at least think we govern the existing economy? You will note that the concept of governance here is similar to that used in engineering or biology. Governance mechanisms keep the components in a system functioning in a controlled and balanced manner, so the system, whether a machine, a human organism, or an economy, will continue functioning effectively. The challenge of governance for the internet economy, then, is whether it can be controlled and directed to meet societal objectives. As a reference point, we might look at the evolution of the internet economy to see what insight that might throw up. Unfortunately, our inherited knowledge from the fields of both economics and communication is not very helpful to developing a comprehensive understanding of the characteristics of a new economy built on a foundation of a new form of communication. The economic theories that underpin policies and regulation for economic governance today do not even recognize communication as a factor in the analysis. Perfect information and communication for economic decision-making is assumed. Although research on the implementation of asymmetric information clearly demonstrates the weaknesses and limitations of standard theories, they do not yet provide an alternative theory as a foundation for policy development. Communication theories, in similar fashion, fail to explain the interrelations between communication and economic processes, or the implications of economic arrangements on basic communication processes. Moreover, theoretical development in both fields tends to focus on static rather than dynamic conditions, providing little guidance for assessing the implications of a new medium of communication, such as the internet, on economic development. The evolution of the internet economy can be seen as having several phases directly associated with government policy decisions liberalizing the role of the market in the telecommunications sector. Perhaps the landmark year in telecommunication liberalization was 1984. Two major events mark that transition year. One was the AT&T divestiture, that is, the breakup of the AT&T monopoly in the United States, and the second was the privatization of British Telecom and the establishment of a regulator, Oftel. The second major event that I think is a landmark in the development of the internet economy is the privatization of the internet by the U.S. National Science Foundation in 1992. These, I think, allow us to establish certain phases in the development of the internet. In the period from 1969 to 1992, we might say the internet was in a phase of research and experimentation. The internet was made possible by liberalization decisions by the U.S. Federal Communications Commission that basically allowed the provision of communication services on the telecommunication network by someone other than the telephone company. This, of course, is what made it possible, the unbundling of the facilities from the services so that the internet as a provision of services on the telecommunications system would be possible. That was not possible by law and by policy in the United States before 1969, and it was not possible in the UK and Europe until the mid-1980s. So the period 1969 to 1992 for the Internet was one of research and experimentation. It was governed by the Department of Defense, the National Science Foundation, the Federal Communications Commission, and AT&T. In economics, we would look at this period of development as one that was developing under what we would call the grants economy. Namely, it was the grant of funds that funded the research and experimentation, and of course, provided the foundation for John Perry Barlow to talk about independence when he was well-funded in the internet development. 1992 to the present is a period of growth in primarily what I would call the internet sector economy. That is, the growth is mostly in the internet sector, in the ICT sector. The development has been focused on self-government, self-governance to promote innovation and growth within that sector, more or less self-contained development. This also has led to the development of major economic interests then around the internet, and with the development of major economic interest, development problems relating to the conflicts in the pursuit of those interests. Now, at the turn of the 21st century, we find that the industry-specific focus of the internet has now broadened sufficiently that we are in the early stages of the development of the internet economy. That meaning the pervasive applications of internet services throughout the economy. And as those pervasive applications begin to grow wider and have more economic significance, problems get exposed. And as we have seen, the demands for and need for some systematic, system-wide governance to address the range of these issues. The recognition of the need for governance of the internet economy has basically come from a decade of what we might call learning by doing in a more liberalized market environment. Throughout the 1990s, the prevailing view was that the internet economy would be a thoroughly deregulated one, and the trend seemed to be in that direction. The absence of regulation in the information technology sector was seen as the source of innovation and rapid beneficial technological change, making the internet possible. The unbundling of services from facilities in the telecommunications sector made internet services possible, and continued telecom liberalization would ultimately lead to the abolishment of telecom regulatory agencies, as the sector could be treated like industry in general, subject only to competition authorities. Thirdly, in the new liberalized environment, internet applications everywhere would improve efficiency and productivity in every industry, leading to unprecedented economic growth in a brave new global economy. In retrospect, that was all pretty naive. Now, internet leaders are calling for strengthened governance involving governments. Effective competition hasn't developed in telecom as expected. Incumbent telcos are seeking protection from regulators and governments. Regulators are discovering new elements of monopoly in the telecommunication network. Some of you may have experienced that when you check your mobile service termination prices. And telecom regulation is being refashioned for the future economy. The widespread use of internet and other frontier ICT services in the financial sector is creating such instability in currency and stock markets that strengthened regulations are being advocated for that sector. And I would note that is the sector that has the leading and most pervasive applications of internet services in providing their financial services. It seems the liberalized internet economy is uncertain, unstable, and downright frightening, if not threatening. Why is this so? Traditional conceptions of market theory and corresponding assumptions of the market models used for designing policy and regulations have treated information and communication activities either as elements of transaction costs between independent trading entities or as search costs associated with taking more informed decisions. In each case, the problem essentially is one of cost minimization or optimizing perceived benefit-cost trade-offs. Even in more dynamic economic models, where attempts are made to make such factors as technological change, innovation, and learning endogenous to the models, the assumed essential characteristic of the market behavior is of simple trading among independent, fully informed, self-interested actors. In such a model, the benefits of the internet can only be positive. Negative consequences are not permitted. They're not permitted by the model. Reality, of course, is a different story. Yet the key characteristics of the evolving internet economy are determined by its distinctive communication properties. Electronically based trading not only changes the character of trading relations between independent buyers and sellers, it fundamentally changes the independent character of the traders, both sellers and buyers, dramatically increasing the significance of interdependencies on both sides of the market. Buyers and sellers are increasingly part of networks of buyers and sellers, which involve a variety of competitive, cooperative relationships. Success in many cases may be determined more by strategic negotiations within networks than by successful trading across networks. And we have seen many examples of this in the ISP and internet services development field. In addition, there are significant network externality benefits from many trading relations. Economists have not yet developed an economics of an internet economy based upon an internet communication system. What then are the principles that one might think about for governance in an internet economy? It seems a governance structure for the internet economy must be built upon a simple, widely accepted principle: access and participation at a global level for communication and information services and innovation opportunities. As a network or network of networks, the internet is clearly global in scope, or at least it is global to those who are connected to the telecommunication network. That's about a third of the world's population. And, of course, to those who can afford PCs and internet access charges, that lowers it some more, and have the scale and living environment to realize some potential benefit from the internet. Making the internet truly global will be an enormous challenge, but making the governance structure truly international seems self-evident. Yet international agencies do not have a record of effectiveness, accomplishment, or real commitment from the most powerful countries, as has been demonstrated vividly recently. International agencies are typically less transparent and accountable than equivalent national agencies and are noted for bureaucracy, inefficiency, and the stifling of innovation. A few years ago, the suggestion that the International Telecommunication Union would be the most appropriate international governance institution for the internet was greeted with universal condemnation based upon the past performance and functioning of the ITU. As the oldest UN agency established to facilitate international standards, coordination, and cooperation in the provision of electronic communication services, the Internet would seem to be a natural, the ITU would seem to be a natural extension from the telegraph and telephone activities. But given the rapid pace of change in Internet development, the ITU is clearly a follower, not a leader. We might then look to other international agencies that might play a role. The World Trade Organization has been established as the key vehicle for liberalizing trade throughout the world. Yet, in its existence and experience, it has developed a reputation not only for secrecy, lack of transparency, lack of accountability, but essentially an organization for big industries in the developed countries to attack the markets in developing countries. In the history of the WTO, there has only been one case where a developing country brought a successful case against a developed country, and having won the case, they realized that any penalties they might impose would hurt them much more than the large country that they had won the case against. So clearly, as a credible agency, the WTO, for a variety of reasons, cannot fill this bill. Before leaving the WTO, I might note the perhaps the most significant issue is that certain industries have not been allowed to be put on the table for WTO negotiations, namely agriculture, textiles, and labor movement. Liberalizing in these sectors, of course, would benefit only developing countries and wouldn't benefit developed countries. So it is certainly difficult to see much credibility in the WTO playing an active role with regard to the Internet economy. Third international agency that would come up for consideration would be the World Intellectual Property Organization. But its reputation isn't too much different than the others. Namely, it exists primarily to protect the intellectual property of dominant firms in developed countries from expropriation by developing countries. The model of international organizations that we have here, and I could go on with others, but the model is essentially the same. The model of these organizations would not be acceptable if our national equivalents functioned in a similar way. With respect to the Internet-specific level of governance, however, I think there is an opportunity to establish a new international agency designed to overcome the problems and deficiencies that have been exposed in the ICANN and in existing international agencies. The challenge is to create a truly international agency that is not simply an institution for negotiating the vested interests in nation states. An agency without national allegiances structured to provide expertise to represent a diversity of interests in implementing network development objectives. In theory, this has great potential. It has great potential simply because internet regulation, internet governance has not been established among governments yet. Yet the issues are clearly international, and one country's interest is really no different than other countries' interest. This would then be the vehicle for the establishment of a new kind of truly international organization. There may be others that attempt to address issues that are more than the special interest of nation states, but certainly in the telecommunication and broadcast and related fields and trade fields, we have not seen one yet. With respect to governance at the second level of the newly converged ICT sector, it is evident that the telecommunication infrastructure, or as it is increasingly called, the information infrastructure, provides the foundation for the cornucopia of internet and other content services, including broadcasting. This network of physical facility connections, made up of a variety of technologies, determines fundamental access and participation opportunities on the internet. Based on the inherent characteristics of these networks, borne out by recent experience, direct regulation is necessary both to overcome market failure deficiencies and to achieve the extra market public interest objective of universal access. We've come to recognize that telecommunication facility networks have a number of distinctive characteristics that prevent competition from being fully effective in promoting efficiency, consumer choice, and public interest policy objectives. These include the requirements for very large-scale investment in fixed network facilities, use of essential, often limited public resources, such as rights of way, radio spectrum, numbers, the presence of significant monopoly power by incumbent operators, the necessity of interconnection among competing networks on reasonable terms, monopoly over the telephone numbers on which calls are terminated, limited consumer choice for some essential services, and expanding requirements for universal services in the internet age. The challenge is defining the governance or regulatory structure to address the specific market failure deficiencies and public interest objectives. And here it seems the principle comes back to the question, to the developments that started the internet, namely the separation of carriage of communication signals from the services and the content. The services and the content include voice services, internet services, broadcast, and other services. The carriage is the physical network capacity over which they all go now in a converged, digitalized telecommunication network. If we think of the role of national versus regional and international regulation in this respect, it seems clear that telecommunication regulation, particularly looking at this part of the world, is essentially, or should be essentially now in the internet economy, the responsibility of Europe, not individual countries. As you will know, the development of a single European market has been underway for at least two decades. A key aspect of the development of European markets is a European telecommunication network. The key aspect of getting a unified, coordinated, single European telecommunication network is to have European governance. European governance, perhaps with national regulation implementing the European-wide telecommunication policies and standards, may be a model for most effective implementation, but clearly the policies that drive the governance should come from the European level. Suggesting then a separation of telecom regulation from broadcast regulation would seem to be called for by these developments, not an integration of the two. Broadcast is just one of many content services on the network. Combining telecom infrastructure with broadcast content regulation invites problems of fairness, consistency, and asymmetric regulation. It attracts undesired political attention to a regulatory institution that is supposed to be and supposed to be seen to be independent, transparent, accountable, and detached from political interests or favored treatment for government organizations. the little I have been able to read in the newspapers about the development of the UK communication bill, in which, if I wish to be informed, I would be informed a lot about Rupert Murdoch, but not much about the rest of the bill, would suggest that a separation of telecom and broadcast regulation would be called for. There's a need for public service broadcasting as part of a program of public services provision of a variety of information. In the internet economy, the public service requirements remain as they have been in an industrial economy. But the public service commitment needs to be redefined for the internet economy and the information society. Moreover, these services are clearly national, whereas telecom infrastructure policy and regulation will increasingly become regional and international. In addition, the need for EU regulation for a single EU telecommunication network is required to serve the current interests in the development of electronic commerce and establish standards for privacy, security, electronic contracts, and other matters important. On issues at the broad level relating to terms and conditions of trade, reform must work through existing institutions. But the internet issues may provide a catalyst for constructive reform. This includes institutions such as the World Trade Organization, the World Intellectual Property Organization, the IMF, and other organizations. And of course, at the national level, we can expect continuing debates over the range of the issues I've touched on, of which I think the most important is clearly the debate over intellectual property rights, which is essentially a debate over the monopoly of information. In conclusion, then, to answer the question I've raised in this presentation, can the internet be governed? As you can tell from what I have said so far, the answer is maybe. How can it be governed? I've outlined a framework and some principles. In theory, the internet can be governed. Whether it can be governed in practice remains an open question and will require continuing research on the spectrum of policy and regulation issues that will make up the overall governance structure. The task ahead is defining precisely the detailed structures for governance of the internet economy to achieve generally acknowledged social objectives. The task is similar to that taken up during the 19th century for the industrial economy by groups of activists in many countries. In Britain, major contributors to that enterprise were the Fabians, and they established an institution for research and education on the issues as part of their activities. Perhaps the LSE can play a role in establishing governance mechanisms for the internet economy of the 21st century, similar to that which it played for the industrial economy more than a century ago. Thank you.
Well, the floor is now open for questions. I've taken my watch off, so it's not there. For at least 20 minutes, the floor is now open, and please raise your hand. I think there are microphones. The acoustics here are not brilliant, so be patient and let the microphone come to you before you speak. I have a question just here, first, and then the second.
Do I need this? Two questions, actually. I apologize if they're too broad-reaching for a concise answer. The first is you mentioned the idea of creating a new international agency for development of the internet for developing countries. And I was wondering how far of a scope, development of the internet, global development of the internet. And my question was, how far of a scope do you think those agencies should go? Because one of the obstacles facing developing countries in terms of establishing the internet is essential questions of things like electrical power. How far of a scope do you think those organizations should have in terms of establishing systems just for basic establishment of the internet within those countries. And the second one was that you mentioned the need for EU regulations for a single network. And one thing I've read in terms of telecoms and incumbents trying to maintain a monopoly advantage is the increasing creation of international networks that help keep out new entrants from creating international networks of their own. So I guess my question was, how do you see EU-wide policy on EU networks influencing this creation, this enabling or inhibiting the creation of a monopoly incumbent network across the EU?
Okay, thank you. I guess first, to be clear, governance institutions don't provide services, and I would not recommend that they do. Governance institutions set a framework often that determines whether or not services can be provided. Research has shown that for developing countries, communication services, and I would include information services also, that can be provided either by conventional telecommunication, simple voice service, or internet-related services, can be a catalyst for development, but only in conjunction with the provision of other services. And you raise a key element. If you don't have electricity, it's likely to be difficult. But what it has shown is the traditional view of development used to be we would prioritize needs and ask the countries, what is your priority of needs? Obviously, water is more important. Electricity is more important. Health is more important. So aid agencies would then work to knock off these needs one at a time. The end result, of course, was that all the programs failed miserably because you can't really have a health system or an education system that works if you don't have communication. You can't build a local economy if the people can't find out whether the market's open or not. So communication has been an integral part of these development programs. In terms of the actual development of networks, the internet opens up possibilities to create strengthened economic viability for networks in many cases. We often think of the necessity to subsidize network development in developing countries. But if you can provide not only a voice service but also access to the internet in a community, then you have a better chance of making it economically viable than before. So if you look at the role of governance, governance can open up possibilities for investment that will stimulate network development. And let me give you a couple of examples, good and bad. I'm now a visiting professor in South Africa and have just come back from South Africa. And they were very happy to see me leave. If you look at South Africa, they have a universal service penetration rate that covers 30% of the households of South Africa. The majority of the population does not have access to the telecommunication system at all. South Africa has four telecommunication networks. The one provided by the telephone company. They have one provided by the electricity company to manage the electricity network. They have one provided by the transport agency to communicate the transport needs of the country. And they have what they call a signal distributor that basically distributes television and radio broadcast signals all over the country. If you put all those together, you would almost have a universal service. But for a variety of historic reasons, that can't be done. If you then ask, well, what about the internet being provided over those networks, well, by law, it must be provided over the telecommunication network, which as a monopoly is a very high-priced network. Well, I have been working with the regulator to try and get the regulator to change all those policies that would allow a governance structure to allow the market to develop the system much further than it has been done before. Most of you who work in development will know the experience of prepaid mobile. Prepaid mobile phones were established for rich professions, doctors, lawyers, plumbers, salesmen, at higher prices than normal mobile service. Prepaid mobile has exploded because poor people have bought mobile service and taken it to rural areas and imaginatively figured out ways to use it to their advantage. Namely, they can control their budget, they can share it with their friends, and they can receive calls. And so when looked at in that environment, it becomes an economically viable proposition to very poor people. In some countries, the regulatory mechanisms don't permit that. In other countries, they encourage it. Look at the experience of Chile. Chile developed a regulatory mechanism that basically said if anyone wants to call the high-cost rural areas, you have to pay a higher price. And it turned out people were willing to pay the higher price, and those areas are viable under that arrangement, whereas the conventional view in telecommunications is we all pay the same price for the same service. So those are examples in terms of development. In terms of the EU, my observation has been it's been the EU that has been pushing liberalization opportunities much more than nation states throughout Europe. And although the UK started first, the UK very quickly lost its lead to the Scandinavian countries and in terms of providing opportunities for network development with new services. And in recent years, the UK has distinguished itself most significantly by being one of the last countries in Europe to unbundle the local loop, which is a way of providing, allowing others to provide services. So here again, I think it's been the strong push at the European level which has led to the opening of opportunities on the network much more than the national level. And I guess from what I have been able to discern from the 572-page draft of the communications bill, I couldn't find anything describing the relation between UK telecommunication regulation and European telecommunication regulation, particularly with regard to fostering European-wide internet developments. I can't say it's not there. It's a long and complicated bill, but it certainly didn't have pride of place.
Thank you. Just here.
Internet is indeed regulated by a body formed either by European governments or international governments. What will the implications be for cyber political activism or anti-government movements or, let's say, movements like the Zapatista movement, which opposes neoliberalism and capitalist globalization? And these movements are increasingly using the internet for mobilization and organization.
I missed the first part of your question. Oh, try again.
I just said that if the internet is indeed regulated by a body formed either by European governments or international governments, what will the implications be for political activism and anti-government movements or movements like the Zapatistas?
I still didn't get that.
As I understand it, it's a question about the role of government, of national, international governments in providing a regulatory framework which would exclude, at the moment, those voices on the internet that are oppositional or critical or radical. Well, in other words, it's a question about internet polity rather than the economy, perhaps.
You mean excluding them from the internet as a matter of policy?
Will there be any implications for them?
Pretty difficult now, I think. To draw the distinction between the, say, governance with regard to the infrastructure for access and participation, which is what I focus on. Then with respect to governance matters on content, this is where we get a variety of rules in different countries. But once you provide access and participation, then trying to provide restrictions with regard to content becomes extremely difficult, as many countries have found now. So if you really want to restrict people, don't give them access. And this, of course, is a problem in particularly in developing countries, where critics of the government just don't have access to the telephone system, so they can't communicate at all. I note just a couple of days ago, the state of Virginia in the U.S. has just passed a new law with regard to the regulation of spam, providing for criminal prosecution and a number of penalties. What isn't clear from what's come out so far is who defines spam. That a definition of spam could infringe on critics and their role, certainly in some jurisdiction. So I think that kind of debate will continue, and different countries will take different positions. But the broader that access to the telecommunication network becomes, and the broader internet access becomes, the more and more difficult it's going to be for any national government to impose significant restrictions.
Thank you. How is the influence of tax law in this context? I would like to know your opinion about the use of taxes to govern the internet economy.
Use of taxes. Taxes, yes. A few years ago, there was a raging debate about the bit tax. And that has since kind of died and gone away. I think the basic principles of taxation haven't changed. Namely, if governments wish to tax to raise funds, there are a variety of ways of doing it, and they use most of them. Income taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, value-added taxes. The question then is there a reason to differentiate internet activities from non-internet activities in terms of taxation? And the concern about the bit tax was that economic trades on the internet did not attract a tax. If the same trade took place off the internet, that would attract a tax. So therefore, fairness and equality would indicate that the trade on the internet should attract the tax. And my view on taxation is, if economic activity is to be taxed, then it should be taxed in the most efficient way possible. And it should be done in a way that does not discriminate against the disadvantaged in society. And with regard to internet trade, then it is really a question of what's possible, what does it cost you to do it, and what are the consequences. I don't see much difference between internet trading activity and non-internet trading activity when it comes to looking at something like taxation. I would tax the revenues. Right? A value-added tax would apply to everything. Establishing a specialized bit tax simply as some kind of new tax doesn't really have a strong logic behind it. Right? That just positions other kinds of trade to have an economic advantage. In terms of economic efficiency, taxes shouldn't be influencing the choices of trading mechanisms that people adopt.
Thanks. This organization you're thinking about, be it global or continent-wide, would they have the power to control which companies set up in developing areas, say, stop another AT&T monopoly?
No. Realistic assessment of an international agency is that it's not likely to have legally enforceable powers that would mean anything. If you think of enforceable powers at a national level, you have a court that you can go to enforce your power. When you look at most international agencies and the way they function now, they provide moral suasion. They can try and embarrass people into doing things, but essentially going to an international court to enforce something is not likely to be efficient. You're not likely to get a decision in your lifetime. So I think it would function the same way other international agencies function. If you look at the ITU, for example, the ITU has no power to make anyone do anything. The ITU is a meeting place for telecommunication government representatives and now industry representatives to negotiate common standards, coordinations, agreements. And if one country says we're not doing it, well, not much they can do about it. Same with the WTO, right? If you followed any of the battles between Europe and North America, the U.S. says they're going to have steel tariffs. Too bad, right? Europe says we're protecting our banana people. So you can play a role there. And particularly when it comes to questions of standardization, questions of, technical standards is an obvious one, but even other kinds of uniform standards that are necessary for global communication or global trade to take place, that most people will accept it most of the time. So my view here is the agencies so far have been dominated by the dominant countries, the dominant industries. They've represented a national interest, a specific industry interest. There's no reason why you couldn't design an agency deliberately that didn't have that remit, that was structured to have transparency, accountability to different objectives, that was staffed with people who were not employed by any particular country. That kind of international agency to try and achieve, we'd say, international objectives. It would go beyond the agencies we've had in at least this field so far. I'd have to say, in all candor, I wouldn't bet any money on its success, but it's a better chance than any of the existing agencies.
I'm curious to know at what level, if at all, do you think that internet search technology could and should be governed? Do you see it as a content issue and thus perhaps belonging in the national level? Or I'm assuming here, if certain internet search organizations achieve the market dominance, would you see that as impinging on internet infrastructural issues and therefore should be regulated at a higher level, or do you feel it just doesn't need regulation at all? Because it does have strong shaping, the character of the search engines has a strong shaping power over how people consume and use the internet.
So you're referring to the internet services market, right? ISPs and...
So Search engines, like search Google engines. Classic League.
Yeah. At least under present conditions, that is a market, I think, that can be treated under the competition authorities. There's no indication that there's significant barriers to entry to getting into the market, there are a number of different search engines. There are certainly conditions of potential monopoly in a search engine. If one search engine gets so superior to others, that there may be significant barriers to entry. But I'd say the first level of addressing it would simply be as a normal competition question.
There's a question just here.
Where you've got a market of back-end applications being done in, for example, South Asia, and the front-end being accomplished in Europe, so you've got the company located both in South Asia and in the, for example, in the UK, where would the implications for, say, data protection or other legislation, who would you see governing that?
Europe.
So how would you see Europe governing, for example, data protection in South Asia?
Europe already sets the policies on data protection. There's been a big flap on the difference between European governance of data protection and U.S. That has been under negotiation for some time. So I think certainly when it comes to individual European nation states, I think the issue has already gravitated to Europe. Nation states may have additional requirements of their own within the country, I'd say Europe is setting the standards. Europe is negotiating with the U.S. and other regions of the world on common standards for data protection that can be employed globally.
You can come back on that if you want. I have another question on my right here.
Hello. This is more at a mundane regional level. We've talked about international and national, but I'm just wondering how you've thought about the unpacking of regional interest, actual economic activity, and the development of internet or an IT infrastructure. Examples in the UK are sort of the deindustrialised northeast, the South Yorkshire coalfields, and so on, where there's a drive to get in broadband, to develop call centres, and so on and so forth. I think then the interesting question becomes what kind of skills, what kind of activity needs to be done for people to feel that they can participate in this new economy. And what sort of voice can the region have within emerging global dynamics? I just wondered.
Yes, I think that is an issue that goes beyond governance. Governance is part of it. Most countries are now in the midst of considering what should the universal access requirements be in the internet economy. And in some cases, there's discussion about broadband access. That then raises the question, is how broad is the broadband? Mm-hmm. Some countries have taken as a matter of policy rather than governance, but as a matter of public policy and government subsidy, Korea, the best example. Have simply said we will have broadband, everyone will have broadband access of 2 megabits or something. And the government has subsidized that. Then I think the question of governance then is on the implementation of that policy. In some countries, issues are raised of internal subsidies. For example, the United States has long had a practice of internal cross subsidies to fund the universal service system. That is one mechanism of funding it, but I think that's a policy question over and above the governance of the network, and I frankly wouldn't recommend the U.S. system. The primary beneficiaries of that system are lawyers and consultants who do studies and argue about how to divide up the spoils. There are other ways of doing that. And I think the question of training, skill and training, is an extremely important one. But again, it's a policy issue that goes beyond governance.
Do you have any more questions? Yes, one last question. You want to come back, do you? I'll come back to you in a minute. Just have, and then we'll close.
How would you police your conceptualization of the internet economy? And if you've got time, how would you answer that question specifically in relation to infringements against intellectual property rights?
Well, I think policing depends what the issue is. If it's let's say, a specific issue of the incumbent monopoly telephone operator excluding people from access, or discriminating in access, or charging prices that are exploitive of customers, that is a standard, now well-established method of regulation. The regulator has the authority to rule. The decision can be appealed to the courts, and the issue is settled in the local court. If it is a European-wide issue, it may involve going to the European Court of Justice to resolve the issue. And there are a number of issues, particularly the global issues relating to content, where the kind of international governance agency I've established is not going to be able to enforce through a legal court system their rules. Enforcement comes with the credibility of the organization. It comes with the publication of the decisions. It comes with the peer pressure put on by others. You might say much the same way as most other international agencies work.
One last, presumably secondary question, but we'll come to
it. Yeah, just to follow on. So you see the situation developing where a country hasn't got the information regulations in place, for example, say Kazakhstan, that European companies are denied the right to actually trade there in their back office environments because they don't comply with the European standard of information regulations, such as data protection, or it could be various acts.
Well, I think those problems will exist for quite some time. I mean, they exist now. The big debate between the US and Europe was that if the European data protection standards were actually enforced, they would find a great many American companies in violation. The American companies would be in violation because they had set up their data collection and usage rules according to U.S. law. So they'd set up their worldwide operations meeting U.S. law. Now Europe comes along and says, hey, we have more stringent rules. And for example, airline information was an issue that came up. That basically if an airline gave certain detailed information about the customers, then that would be in violation of the rules. And U.S. Airlines said, we can't function that way. Our whole information system is set up to gather all this information to help us provide what we think is better service. So what in the U.S. view was better service, in the European view was an invasion of privacy. So I think those things have got to be sorted out. We're a long way from having a global vision on that. Right? The U.S. is clearly the most liberal in terms of allowing, we might say, the invasion of your privacy to get data because of the view that it allows these companies to function more efficiently. You might say at the other extreme, China does not exactly have a similar sort of view. So you say, how do those things get resolved? They are issues that could get resolved in the kind of global internet organization I have suggested. they get resolved by discussion and debate and agreement on a set of principles which would then be known and would be applied everywhere. But I think realistically, we're a long way from that. Right now, if you look at the differential standards around the world, I suspect you'd find at least 50. Give you an example. Again, my current knowledge is South Africa. ICANN was thinking of having one of its big meetings in Cape Town. And then they discovered that ICANN practices violate South African law, and if they went to Cape Town, they all might end up in jail. So they decided they'd meet somewhere else.
Thank you for your question. Thank you for your answer. And thank you very much indeed for your lecture tonight. Thanks very much indeed. Dining room on the fifth floor of the old building, which will follow as soon as you get there.